Broadly, our topic tonight is on the American Revolution. We have things on the board that sort of go with what I'm teaching. One thing is we have a three-way triangle that is going to factor into this. It's the French and Indian War, which is not the war of the Indians and the French. It's a war against Britain and the Indians allied with the French. And it becomes a global, we might call it a world war, because it does not happen in the America. It happens in Europe. All the major players in Europe are involved in it. Then we have Britain, of course, with its church, I should say, France. We have the Indians with the French, and we have Spain with the French. And I've figured out Spain never does anything worthwhile. If anybody here from Spain, seemed like they just sort of like, and then we have all of that group's Catholic, and then we have Britain over here and its Church of England. They're doing everything they can to keep out of the Catholic Church, and there's all the Catholics doing everything they can to get back into England. And then we have the colonies, who are Puritan in extract and Protestants broadly, and have a mean streak in them too. So these things war against each other. We're in the revolutionary period. I'm going to call it from 1770. That's the time of Whitfield's death. I just picked that as a nice break-off point. And then go up through 1790, which takes us through the beginning of the French Revolution, or the French Revolution, which is a revolution that goes on just a little bit after the American Revolution. And it's also a world-class revolution. So that 20-year period. And during that period, we have the national independence declared 1776. A few things happened before that. Congress already meets. The war continues on with Britain until 1783. Then we had the French-Indian War. About the date of that, it's a seven-year war with 9 years in it. So I figured I have my math guy over here explain that to me, and he couldn't. But the way you have 9 years to seven is I think the world becomes involved after 2 years, so that becomes called the seven-year war, but it's really the French Indian War that lasted 9 years or 7 years. And it's not to be confused with the Indian skirmishes that we had in the beginning of the life of Jonathan Edwards. He was a child, unaware, of course, when the kidnapping occurred at Deerfield and Williams was taken captive and he went to Canada. That's not the French Indian War. That's the war with Indians, and the French were on the Indian side, but it wasn't the war we're talking about. So that was a little confusing. I got that figured out a while ago. So we're talking about this major world conflict is the French and Indian War with Britain. So that's from 1754 to 1763. And the world is, Britain and France are, they're sore after being beat up on each other. So they're a little sensitive to each other, especially Britain is towards France and gives French, the Catholics, some things that the people in the colonies didn't like, because the colonies hated the French, the Catholics more than they did the Indians, were more afraid of the Catholics than were of the Indians. And so when the Catholics got some benefits, that really, was one of the logs that helped fuel the American Revolution. So I tell you what I'm going to tell you. So that's mostly what I got up there is up there. All right. So we're going to do probably another lesson around the Revolution, maybe do some personalities, because a lot of people want to know about these people. Some people think they're Christians, and we'll talk a little bit about that, and I'll explain a little bit how hard it is to find that out from our vantage point. So we'll start the Great Awakening, Second Great Awakening, which starts a little before 1800. And I want to take a whole lesson and do one on Darby, because he's at 1820. So we're coming up on that. So what I want to do for you all is sort of hit the major events of time as we go towards our day. And we cannot miss Darby for his contribution to dispensational theology. And I will tell you some of the good stuff and some of the bad stuff. He didn't have it perfect, but he certainly was a significant contribution to us. And if I can rattling on like this, we'll never get done tonight. So the Great Awakenings, I'm going to call this our second part of our series. The second part's between the Great Awakenings, the colonies achieve independence. And if you want to keep track of who was the king in England, you just have to think of George, right? George the Third instead of George Washington. So we have two Georges, you know, competing. So that's the easy one to remember. And the Great Awakenings are in the shaded areas. We have the first ones, didn't last terribly long. In fact, I was generous with its span, because sometimes they call the Great Awakening died out pretty quick after a few years, even in the 1740s. But the Second Great Awakening lasted a lot longer. As we know, it's a different character of Great Awakening. And in between these two Great Awakenings, we have this period we call the Revolutionary Period. Now, if you ever read Tale of Two Cities, you know that it starts out by the courier catches up with the stagecoach, and they pull out a letter and reads it to him. So this is what we have here. And this is in the time of we're talking about. The time of the American Revolution was trying time in the world. It was the time surrounding this French Revolution, described by Dickens in his Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times. England had won the French and Indian War. Just talked about that. That aligned with the Western nations on one side, Britain, and the other with France. So Britain came out the winner on that one. But it was not so good for the French. They lost the heads of the monarchy, literally. They lost their religion, Catholicism. They gave the Enlightenment humanists a real chance to govern. Give them a chance, but it also kept the guillotine busy with executions based on a whim. So for France, losing to the British, the territories, the national prestige, the king and queen, and the goodwill of the people, it was the worst of times. And I say then, what a great time for Napoleon to come on the scene. That's exactly what happened, to give France their prestige back. But by the time of the French Revolution, England, too, had lost her colonies in the upstart rebels. By the upstart rebels, Britain had smothering debt, fought too many wars, lost the power of an expanding empire, couldn't handle the Barbary Wars in the Mediterranean. They were unwinnable, so they kept on paying high ransom to bring cargo into the Mediterranean Sea. So they had no access or limited access to the Middle East. So it was also the worst of times for Britain then. So it is to this time we turn in our lesson today. Part one, we have the Pilgrims in Whitfield. Part two will be the pre-revolutionary and revolutionary period. Now, just that you have these names in your mind, that you'll be able to read these, recite these in your sleep before you go to bed at night, just to have the major events in order, maybe I should write this out for you to memorize. You got the Pilgrims, you got the Puritans, and Roger Williams, who didn't talk about him very much, 1642. Eleazar Mathers, at the end of the decline of the Puritans. Solomon Stoddard tries to save the Puritan movement. Jonathan Edwards ends up being the last Puritan and the first evangelical. And then we have George Whitefield in Britain, and comes to have international fame, and broke the Church of England's back in America by preaching new birth. And out of that, a lot of churches were established in America. And Wesley gets an honorable mention here because of the independence that he fostered for the churches in America, because he started to ordain people outside the Church of England. When you start doing that, you lose your contact with the mother church, so to speak. So those are the people we have kept track of in the first section. Now, the born-again awakening will continue into the revolutionary period. Whitefield, you know, preached till 1770. In fact, he was preaching the day he died. The first stirrings in Massachusetts were in 1735, with the Zeniths in 1740. By the time of the American independence in 1776, those who were saved in this first wave would be 16 years old plus another 36. So I'm saying 52-ish. So here, it's kind of some numbers. If you're 20 years old and saved at the beginning of it, you add these to it. So you have these men that were oldest, 76 years old, but a lot of them would have been younger men. And some of them could be already second generation after that first wave of the Great Awakening. So generally, these are young men. And all I'm doing here is reminding you that God doesn't have grandchildren. So if your parents are saved, but that doesn't mean necessarily the children were. So it doesn't mean there's a continual line of Christianity. Now you put George Washington into this mix. He was born in 1732. So at the Great Awakening, he would have been 8 years old and was 44 at the time of independence. Gives you the kind of framework where these, how long ago this Great Awakening was. Of course, Whitfield preached until September 1770, only six years before independence, and already things were in the mill concerning independence. Now, this next part is sort of a lesson in, I don't know for sure what, how to read a book, I guess, how to read history book, and I'm not sure this is the last word. But we got to do something with history because we don't have much help as dispensationalists in history like we're going to study tonight. In fact, I'll tell you about this in a minute, so I'll tell you now. It's hard to find literature that's dependable. So it is the nature of historians that they want to decide things. You know, they want to be the last word. That is, they want to explain things, and I've said that, why you study history, because it explains things. Things of the past are organized in some meaningful way, thoughtful way by historians. Any historian will be pressured to decide about things, give reasons, purposes, consequences about the event, and you're in a history class about the awakenings. I'm probably going to do the same thing. So we're all going to be pressed to decide things. I had up there, is America a Christian nation? That's a pressure point to decide, okay? We're all going to be pressed to decide things. We will discuss one of the most discussed historical things that historians discuss, and that's the Great American Revolution. So it's not surprising for us because it's our nation's history. So every historian stands to discuss history from a given vantage point. That is, the beginning point can drastically change the look of an event. The vantage point includes the historian's worldview, his experiences, and I might add his conviction, I call it his faith, I don't like that word, but his religious beliefs, his general knowledge about everything, anything, or lack of it, and so forth, and even his personality. All these factor into what a historian conclude about an event. So every historian will likely see each event a little differently. So for us, Christians with a high view of Scripture, which means dispensational premillennialists, we are hard-pressed to find others like us who observe and assess history from our vantage point. In fact, I almost said it's impossible. If you know of stuff out there, I mean, I'm the first guy to read this stuff. I'll explain a little bit more. So my fear in discussing our subject, the American Revolution, is that as an amateur, me, I will be left with few, if any, reliable resources to help decide things. As we said, the vantage point of the historian makes a huge difference in how they see history. Certainly, the theological vantage point of a historian will influence his judgment, and his writings will reflect it. So one must know the historian's proclivities on account and account for them in his conclusion. If he's a Catholic writer, I got to know that. And if he's a dispensational writer, I know that. And if I'm reading theology that's sensitive to dispensational issues or literal reading of Scripture issues, then I want to know that. That doesn't mean I don't read him. I just got to know who he is. Okay. In our book on Wednesday morning, we were reading about Jewish Christianity, Jews and Christianity. The questions that the guys are having trouble with is they don't know who the authors are that are being cited. Are they good guys or bad guys? And if you don't know that, you don't know what to do with what they said. So just important, we got to know who we're reading and what their positions are. And if you don't know, get on the internet and find out. That's how I do it, at least. What school did they go to? Where are they now? And that doesn't always help, but do something about it. So all of my books that I have in my library, and there are not that many, but I do kind of collect historical stuff, history stuff. And those that I've searched on online stores, and I asked our resident librarian if she knew of any, and she said, well, let me think. And she has not talked to me since. So I think she's still thinking. So there are none that are from a dispensational premillennial or dispensational premillennial writers. Now, as a caveat here, there are writers that refer to history, as Tommy Ice, who knows a lot about history, and the company of the Future of Study Group, but to my knowledge, there are none that write to the level of the George Marsdens or the Nathan Hatches or the Mark Knowles, and they're somewhat on our blacklist because of their theology. But they make a significant contribution, which I'll explain in a minute. So we're talking about assessing the Christian aspects of the time of the American Revolution, and we're looking for somebody that can help us do that. I'm the guy looking for that. So I got to categorize these guys and these authors into, they're not always guys, there's gals on this too, categorize them into groups. First of all, it would be the furthest out. These are the historic observers. They observe Christianity. A lot of them are not believers. They write about what they see. I won't start naming any of these. There are these historic observers of Christianity who may or not be born again, who make no such claim, but can make some contributions, because when you go to history, what you really want out of the historical investigation are the facts. What happened? Okay? So they can do that. They can say George Washington was the president. I mean, anybody can do that. You don't have to be a believer to do that. Now, the group two is there are some who do not reveal their convictions concerning their personal faith. So you kind of read between the lines. Because a good historian, they say, wants to hide their bias and be objective. And I just remember we about 10 years ago, 20 years ago, whatever, on the more liberal media's anchors started not to wear the American flag at the, on the lapel because they were going to be objective. And then people raised an objection against that because you may be an objective, but you are an American. And if you don't want to be an American, don't be reporting news to us, you know. So we expect a little bit of bias from you that would cast the news a little bit in our favor. At least we know that's what he's doing. But anyway, that little flap about wearing the U.S. flag on lapel was because they were above any politics. Well, that's not true. So number great group three, and this is where I'm going to resource. Some write from an obvious Christian perspective, declare themselves so, as our authors do. However, they are not necessarily safe havens either because their biblical perspective can be corrupted. But I coined a new word here for you guys. Hang on. By replacementism. All right. They believe in replacement theology. All right. They're covenant theology guys. So the book I'm going to use, not the only one I use, but it is The Search for Christian America by Knoll, Hatch, and Marsden. I'll explain who these guys are in a minute. They're not necessarily safe even either. It would seem that these men are Christians, I believe, in the sense of claiming the evangelical understanding of the gospel. So I put them in group three, although Knoll, after being at Wheaton, joined Notre Dame's faculty. Hatch, who graduated from Wheaton, is president of Wake Forest Baptist Founded School. And George Marsden is a faculty of the Notre Dame School. So the two of these three guys are Catholic on Catholic faculty. Now, remember, in academic freedom, you have probably a little more latitude than we might think you could have in a church, but I'm excusing them here a little bit. So that's where they are. And they didn't spend all their life there, but that's where they are as far as I know now. So I have used this book in this work. And they raise the appropriate questions surrounding the First Awakening and American Revolution and the place that the Awakening played in the American Revolution. So they deal with these subjects directly, and that's why I use them. I got to go somewhere. I didn't live back those days. I got to take somebody's word for it. But in their early pages of the book, they say this, which I really appreciate. You don't have to dig this out. They get up front with it. This is a quote. Before we turn, they say, to the chapters below, to more specific examinations of the various themes and historical matters suggested in this introduction, it would be well to state positively what we, the authors, consider proper biblical principles for our attitudes to the American nation and its heritage. And I say thank you for your open honesty. Quote continues, in the first place, we must agree with Roger Williams that no nation since the coming of Christ has been uniquely God's chosen people. Are we okay so far? We're okay so far. Notice how he carefully set states, it's no nation since the coming of Christ has there been a uniquely God-chosen people. We would agree with that. Now, the next phrase, the New Testament teaches unmistakably that Christ set aside national and ethnic barriers and that he has chosen to fulfill his central purposes in history through the church. Now do I hear it? Eh. All right. So see, but we know at least where he is, all right? That doesn't make it easy to read, but we at least know where he is. He goes on to say, this church now transcends all such former boundaries. We're not done yet. So Samuel Hopkins, a pupil of Jonathan Edwards, still quoting him, them, I don't know who's writing where. Samuel Hopkins, a pupil of Jonathan Edwards, reached a similar conclusion at the end of the American Revolution, end of his quote. Now, Ed, when I say Ed, that's me. Hopkins attacked the idea that God was blessing America in his struggle for independence against Britain. He didn't like that. He didn't think that God was helping America against Britain as a political thing. He reputed the idea that God was somehow designating the nation of America as his special people and therefore justifying its continuation of slavery. When I have a statement like that, it's too much to unpack. I just said, it's too messed up. Just leave it alone. It's off track. And I noticed here, and I don't know if I'll get this worked in very well this night or not, but slavery becomes a huge issue, and I call it a moralistic issue, okay, in this period and through the time of our Civil War. Now, this goes back to the quote. Israel, Hopkins said, could enslave Canaanites, reading the Old Testament, because of God's express permission. But this was one of those many directions and laws to the Jews which had no respect to mankind in general. So that was for them, and it's not for us. And to that extent, we would agree. Now things are different. The distinction of Israel is at an end. Okay, there it is, very clear. And all the nations are put upon a level. Everybody's the same. Christ has taught us to look on all nations as our neighbors and our brethren. So the point they make is that there are no national distinctions, not even Israel. There's only the church. Graphically, we can show it this way. We have all, I don't know if I got my little pointer up here or not. But all these nations that exist, and I just picked out those that you know, Persia, Greek, and Roman, all these nations that we know in the past, they definitely existed, and so did Israel. But when you come to Christ, it says Christ rearranged the Old Testament expectations. So when Christ came on the scene, it's like a meat grinder, I guess. You put in something and it grinds it up and it comes out different, all ground up. So what you come out with is that the church of all nations is the change agent for all the nations without distinction. So the church becomes the vehicle through which God is going to act. And all these national distinctions that were before Christ came have been done away with. Now, we have a real problem with that, with God's word. I mean, this gets on another subject we're not going to talk about tonight, but when God says something is going to be forever, and all of a sudden it's not forever, then we have a question about whether God's word is any different than man's word, because man changes his mind, so God changes his mind. No, we don't want to do that. But that's what they do. That's why I have difficulty with this. So somehow, in the long run, when the church with all the nations in it will live long enough, somehow, depending on they have two perspectives here. If it will improve and get better, then you are a post-millennialist, and then the Lord will return when the moral job is done by the church. So there, all righteousness will dwell. All right. Now, the better way of looking at this, those national distinctions continue. I could have brought those clear on over. They are not necessarily Egypt. All the Egypt still exists, but all these other nations may not exist as they are. But Israel continues to have national promises, and the church that is gathered out of all these nations, and I could have also included Israel at this point, include Israel, the individual people of it. When they become born again, they're part of the church, and so this is now a witness to these nations. They don't organize the nations, but they're a witness to the nations. There's witness agent to the nations as a new creation. And then at the end of this time, getting into the details here, the kingdom comes where righteousness will dwell. All right, so they don't go that way. So we have a problem here trying to unpack what they're saying and get what we can out of it. I spent probably a half hour writing this, and I don't know that I've got it right yet. So let's try. So the dispensational premillennialism idea of the scripture is ignored. Now, they would make sense. The rebels do not take into account that the eternal promises made to Israel, but assume the blessings are now given to the Christians. Now, that's the author's assumption. They look at the rebels, and they're critical of them. They're critical of them because the rebels were pursuing Christian nation building. But our historians disagree with the revolutionaries, same people, who are wrong in assuming the literal nation-building promises. So rebels want to build nations. Our author said they shouldn't be building nations. That is, they are critical of the rebels and assuming a special blessing on the Christians. They're against this. These authors are against this. But our historians do not believe in a future Israel kingdom either. You can't build a Christian nation, and you can't build a Jewish nation. So they're going to rule both of these out. Remember, all of the nations are without distinction. But our historians do not believe in a future Jewish kingdom either. They disagree with the rebels' Christian nation-building activity, but hold to an all-nations entity called the church, which is going to stand for righteousness. So the bottom line is they would see all nation-building as wrong. All nation-building is wrong, whether it's Jewish or whether it's Christian. Now, not everybody that's on the replacement-ism side would agree with the statement. Those that are post-millennial, and we call it neo-post-millennial, they want to build a nation on earth. They want to pass laws to build this nation. So that's why I say you have to know who these guys are and understand the theology and then got to move forward. So that's what these guys are. They're basically amillennial, not post-millennial. They want to build a nation. And they don't think anybody else should either. And so what you have left then is amillennials. You don't have any kingdom, so you just have the church, and it does its job. Okay. Now, if that doesn't confuse you, it should have. Yes, that's what the rebels, some of them wanted to do. Some of them wanted to do that. And they said that's wrong. And they said, in fact, if Israel wants to do it, it's wrong.
Like the Puritans,
exactly, right. So I did this for you just because to show how difficult it is to find literature that says what you wanted to say. Because now I understand the guy's probably amillennial. I knew that before. But I know he is, and so anything he says about Israel is going to be off base. And then I have some questions about, well, at least he doesn't want to build a nation like the post-millennialists want to do. He's against that, so that's good. Well, that makes him an amillennialist because that's all that's left. I'm going to say that here. So one thing about the authors and the revolutionaries have in common is that they believe that Christian action by nation or by the church is to be the salt and light to change the moral behavior of society. They agree with that. The church should change society. These revolutionaries thought the Christianity should change society. They say what good is the church if it does not change culture? Remember, there is no messianic Jewish kingdom coming. So Christians in the church are to establish righteousness so that the king can come and claim the moral work of the saints. And the saints have got the work done already. So we have variations of this from amill to postmill. And these guys end up being amill. And these immoral behaviors, talking about the moralism, we got to fix that's bad out there. These immoral behaviors are legion. But the grandest of all sin is the sin of slavery. That keeps coming back again and again and again. All of the moralism that we see coming strongly from, say, 1750 is driven by a self-righteous attitude found in Arminian theology, where man makes the decision. The salvation of the soul through good works is moralism. Slavery is a great blot on Christianity that must be removed. That becomes a moral issue as almost tantamount to salvation. Both the rebels and our historians reporting on them are mixed up in two different ways. They're mixed up. They both end up in the wrong place. They're just mixed up in different ways. So the historian will correct or critique the revolution based on his own mixed up ideas of the end of history. They are critical of the revolutionary Christian nation expectation, which has Christ return after Christianizing it, perfecting the world. So our historians must adopt the only other option open to them, and that's amillennialism. Both have written out any Jewish hope. By the way, post-millennialism continues to be around through the Civil War and even later. And we know the song from the Battle Hymn of the Republic, "My eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." This is post-millennial. "He has trampled out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He has loosed the faithful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. I have seen him in the watchfires, 100 circling camps, that builded him an altar in the evening dews and damps. I can read his righteous sentence in the dim and flaring lamps. His day is marching on. The kingdom is coming. The millennium is being brought in by these good works." And slavery, remember, is the issue behind the Battle Hymn of the Republic. "I have read the fiery gospel, writ and burnished, rose of steel, as ye deal with my contemners, I don't know what that word is, so with you my grace shall deal. Let the hero born of woman crush the serpent with his head, since God is marching on. He has sounded forth the trumpet. He shall never call retreat. He is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat. Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on." So the whole context here is the kingdom is coming, and they're doing this moral work. With the greatest work of all is eliminating slavery in Christian, quote, America. Yes, right, right. But they already see parts of it coming, and they're going to have it happen. Well, since we're talking about song, we were talking about this morning about the song, "Life is Like a Mountain Railroad." It went to my head, and I said, you know, one of the lines is, keep your hand upon the throttle and your eyes upon the rail. And the rail, when I teach my hermeneutics class, I always say there's two rails that keep us on track. One is the hermeneutics rail, is historic, you know, truth, and grammatical rules. So we have the historic, those two rails keep us on track. So I thought it was kind of appropriate that we talk about the Mountain Railroad tracks that keep us on track. These guys are off track. So we've taken this trip through the Mountain Railroad to show you, warn you, of the danger of relying on Christian historians who are not dispensational premillennialists. From this historical point forward, we have an increasingly Arminian church taking front and center stage, assuming the change agent for society, even with good intentions. Their theology degenerates into old-fashioned moralism, further weakening Christian practices, even adopting Unitarianism, which is a fashionable term for atheism. That's where it goes. Remember the Puritan churches. You follow the trace out, the end of that road is a Unitarian church. And the only thing that keeps you on track is the two rails, grammatical, historical view of Scripture, interpretation of Scripture. So now the big question is, so why do you mess with all this? So what do these historians bring us? We just throw them away? I'd like to, in a way. Well, at least they acknowledge God, who is involved and active in affairs of men. That's got to give that. They are able to recognize theological categories, even if they do not necessarily hold them. And if they're honest, they can point out they can point them out. They can point out gospel compromises, but they characteristically present a soft Christian perspective that usually goes with it. Since they will not stand for the literal word, they are at a loss exactly what part of the word they should die for. So you end up having this softness. So is it safer to read and acknowledge a secular writer, just forget the Christian writers? Well, perhaps. We got to find these first, because a lot of times they don't write about stuff we want to know. Perhaps because to read a historian who is a Christian, we need to know or be able to determine the theological presuppositions, as I have done in these lessons. We will have a different outcome if we do that than the authors, but much can be learned from them in spite of their weakness. Of course, much of the historical writing is to know the facts. As I said before, we just have to give us the facts, we take care of the rest of it. So the conclusion are many and can be formed on the facts. Christians understand Puritans better than seculars do, who only see witch hunting and miss all the rest. So that's why we almost need a Christian perspective, even though it may be a little bit off. Now to our task. The question is America a Christian nation? I know you'd want to hold your judgment, wouldn't you? I say, who wants to know? I mean, that's where I say, who wants to know? I mean, do you want to know it to do something with it? Well, the critic of Christianity wants to know so he can attack it, right, with his invectives. Some Christians want to know because, well, was the revolution moral, immoral, or was it blessed of God or what? You know, so if we have Christian nation here and it's doing these things, how do you explain Christians doing this thing? So in a way, it's really set up to do a trap. And I really think, I don't really care whether it's considered a Christian nation or not. I mean, in a book, I don't know that it matters. So I think it's a loaded question. If America is a Christian nation, then I would ask, what are the standards for Christian nations? How many people in the nation have to be Christians? How many have to be born-again Christians? How many of those can just be aspiring Christians? How many of those that are moral Christians don't do anything bad? Are we still a Christian nation? You see, it's difficult now to come to it, so it's, I say it's almost a loaded question. Now, if America is not a Christian nation, why have so many Christians been found here, on the other hand? Why has America been good to the other nations? Why so much moral good from this nation? And there has been moral good. So we can dispense of the question by just saying it all depends on how you define Christian nation, right? Since the Bible does not do this, it does not do this, does not say what a Christian nation is, doesn't say what the percentage have to be, you know, it doesn't do any of this stuff. Since the Bible does not do this except by general principles laid down that the nation as a minimum must acknowledge and obey God, their creator, it could be yes. In that sense, it could be a Christian nation. In its founding purposes, if we look back to the Mayflower Pact, it was Christian in its original founding before the men and women put foot on land. In practice, there really can be no Christian nation. In practice, because they'd all have to be Christians. Now we get mixed up because we look at the Jewish nation and they were Jews. Did all Jews go to heaven? No. All right. But we had a Jewish nation because they were all Jewish. So we can't say that the nation is Christian because they're not all Christians. Now they tried to approximate this with baptism, right? A birthright, something approximating the church by infant baptism. But there's no ownership as with the Jewish baby could claim, you know, being Jewish. So since children are not born into Christianity, even though you might think they are not. Most nations have a small minority that are born again. And I say most nations have a small minority. In America, I have all kinds. I try to figure this out. In all the way from 30 to 80% people are considered born-again Christians. And I guess if somebody puts a microphone in your mouth and he says, are you a born-again Christian? And you'd say no, you'd probably condemn yourself. So you'd probably say yes and not mean it. So I don't know if there's any statistics here that are valid. But we probably say there's more here than other places. We could say that. Now, as to intent, maybe this is where you really decide this question. As to intent, America perhaps was and is a Christian nation. That was the intention. Now, the intention, however, is more inspirational than by strict theology. Now, we like the idea of it. We want to do things that Christians do. We like the morals of it. We like the orderliness of it. You know, and then we mix in with some good theology, and then some of it rubs off, and some of it, you know, is understood. So I kind of say America's a Christian nation in an inspirational sense, but not in a theological sense. Now, does that make any difference? Does it help anything? I don't know. That's where I'm going to leave it. One more here. If the people acted as if they were answerable to God in a Christian nation, perhaps it could be a Christian nation, but it's not so. It is more like a consensus. It is better to be Christian than a whatever. There's not much to be gained one way or another, I don't think. If God intended the United States to be a Christian nation, he did not mention it. Did he? I haven't found it yet. If he meant it but did not mention it, then we are left with our old options again. So we still don't really have an answer from God. Remember, all nations do his bidding, whether they acknowledge him or not. So it isn't that, well, this nation obeys God, this one doesn't. Hey, they all do. Even Cyrus of Persia are a good example. Now the next question, did the awakening cause the revolution? The best answer is no, it did not cause the revolution. But revolutions are never, and here I never say never, never say anything emphatically, there's probably one somewhere, have a simple or a simple cause. I mean, they're usually complicated, as this one is. So it is possible that a born-again experience processed through a faulty eschatology, postmillennialism, may have joined other forces, but to make emphatic statements run the risk of error. That the awakening actually caused the revolution, I doubt it. Now, there were ambiguities about going to war with Christian brothers. So they were pacifists, and they were, like I say, they were hawks, and they were pacifists. So nothing is clear here. So what was this? This was, no, did not, I would say no. But there are some things that would kind of make you think it pushed it in that direction. These are our next considerations. Second consideration may give some credit or cause to the Christian motives of the revolution. One was the fact that the Christians read their Bibles as historicists. Now, that's not good. Historicists read the Bible to see what they should do today or see who the enemy is today. That is, they saw their political situation in the text of the Bible. Tyranny, just use that word. Bad things happen to you. All right, there's always tyranny out there. And tyranny is seen in the Bible. So whatever tyranny there is in the Bible is related to the tyranny that's happening today. So tyranny in the Bible is pointed to the French, the Catholics, to the Parliament, to the Pope, or whatever. So tyranny was the Antichrist who was attacked wherever he was found. And I say there's a lot of tyranny around those days. So tyranny, like the devil, was to be resisted. Thus, all these mentioned at one time filled the role of tyranny and supported Christians' oppositions to it. So if there's tyranny out there, we've got to oppose it, you know, wherever it's found. So this tyranny was a rolling tyranny, never stopped, never was the same person, never stayed put. It depended on the situation. There was no restraint on wild speculation, so anybody could be a tyrannical influence. Another idea to promote Christian revolution was the idea of freedom. Now, loose Bible reading turned to spiritual freedom in Christ to political freedom as slaves. Now, I remember when John Wesley wanted to make a decision, what did he do? Opened the Bible and, you know, closed his eyes and pointed at a verse and said, that's what I need to do today. That's kind of what the historians do. All right, so we have this going on. So when you see, you go like this, freedom in the Bible, it says freedom, that means political freedom. It didn't mean that context meant that. No, it just says freedom, that's, we need to have freedom. So we have freedom in Christ, we should have freedom over here too. So they make it a political issue. So the context of which freedom, the context of which freedom did not serve as a control agent. So when the idea of freedom was mentioned, it was applied willy-nilly to freedom from England. Now, we think that's kind of a stretch. Well, that's not really, because people read the Bible that way today. Then after the war, even some of the colonists, when they understood the war was run by Britain, identified the new nation as the stone cut out without hands of Daniel chapter 2 that crushed all the other empires. That's a stretch. But, you know, they're historicists. They'll look in the Bible for something that fits our day today, and they apply it. No control, no tracks, no grammatical historical. So we'll do anything you want. So with this kind of spiritualized application of Bible to historic events, it may have seemed to some that this was surely a chosen nation as Israel had been. Now, these are the things that would have pushed it towards, Christians would have pushed it toward, but it was a misguided Christianity, of course. Well, let's bring some sanity to this issue. The role of the United States. Now, this is where you will not get this from any of these writers. To bring some sanity to the issue, we have Peter's sermon, Acts 17:26. It says, he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. That is true. And that's true for America. It's true for England. It's true for France, for every nation. In this sense, every nation has a special appointment. Are they an elect nation? In a broad sense, of course. God is a superintendent sovereign over all. So they all make their appointments. None have the appointment as Israel had, a covenanted nation. None have that. Even America, especially been prepared for its mission, it still would not be a covenanted nation as Israel is, not was. So with these comments about the religion of the day and the role it had with the break with England, we now look at the political realities that were on the ground, the things that we'd read about in the newspaper. You may want to designate America as a chosen nation, a question of terminology here, for a Jewish task. It cannot be denied that in respect to God, in retrospect, God was preparing the United States for divinely appointed mission. It needed 150 years to grow it into a superpower. So let's look back a little bit. First, as a harbor for Jewish persecution, remember, most of the Jews were parked in Poland from about 1000 AD. And that's where we get the word the Pale. The Jews lived in the Pale. And if you were outside the pale, you were beyond the pale, right? So they were left in their spot. And they were in Poland, and they were sometimes in Russia, not because they moved. No, it was because the borders moved. So if you're in Russia and Poland, Russia, Jews, they moved the borders. All right, my lesson earlier, we had that. All right. So the first harbor, major harbor, was Poland, where the Jews could go. So they started to come to America. See, I'm going to guess at these dates. I may not be exactly right, but they are in three waves. And I thought, interestingly enough, in three waves. They left the land of Israel to go to Babylon in three waves. They came from Babylon back into the land in three waves. They come into America in three waves. Interesting. I don't know why that's interesting. So they come back 1654, maybe way before this, 1840 after this, and 1924 after World War I. It became a gathering place after Poland. Okay, that's the first thing that happened with America. And by the way, America has never expelled the Jews, which is not true of, I think, every other country has. You know, I would say that almost with the, you know, quite sureness, at least major countries. So that's interesting because America has been prepared as a place for the Jews to go when they were losing their welcome elsewhere. Second, there's other stories about that. Second, a force to deliver the land out of the German-Turkish hands of World War I, potentially into the hands of the Jews. Again, America was the when they entered the World War I, the war was finished very soon. And President Wilson, at that time, without President Wilson's personal support of Lord Balfour, who came to America to ask him to support the idea of a land for Israel, Wilson said, "I'm with you, but I can't be public about it. Someday when I can, I will." And Balfour went back with that assurance, and he sent his letter to Rothschild saying that England prepared to establish a land for the Jews. Wilson had a role in that. All right, talking about America as being a benefactor to the Jews here. Thirdly, the United States was also used, World War II, to bring the Jews back to the land. England could not have done it. France was done. You just name it. It was whatever. And Russia could never have defended against Germany either, although there's some questions about that, whether Germany had already overreached itself. But without the United States helping Russian establish Russia, it would have been a lot different outcome. So thirdly, the United States was also used in World War II to bring the Jews back to the land. The land was prepared for them in World War II. People were prepared for the land in World War II. So they defeated Nazi Germany. So without Truman's recognition of Israel, we would not be a nation. France helped Israel when and the United States didn't. And the Brits, of course, they were turncoats and turned their back on Israel as soon as they could. Warplanes would come from the United States. And the very interesting story about all that, during that War of Independence from 48 to 49, a story, someday we'll do a movie here for you, that talks about the benefit the United States gave to Israel in an informal way. We're drawing the borders. Now, with the deliverance of the Jews to their land in mind, notice how craftily the nations that laid claim to the New World territories are being eliminated so that he who sets the boundaries will craft the United States. The claimant nations are the French, the Spanish, the Dutch, the British, and even if we may include the natives of the land. While we claim no biblical wisdom here, but got to remember the Indians were spiritists and worshipers of pagan gods, and God generally doesn't tolerate that forever. So it's just a matter of removing some of these for what God is doing in the next level. So it's not beyond the imagination, or of our imagination, that God saw fit to remove them as a force in the land. This flies in the face with secular anthropology, but God does not tolerate pagan worship forever. Did the British and the French make mistakes? Most certainly they did. But in broad strokes, we ought not to discount this border drawing possibility as an ultimate underlying factor. Other civilized nations were moved out too for a lot less reasons. You might want to think about that. All right, so we have this period of time, the Great Awakening, the time of independence, the Second Awakening, and below it in the green we go from a Calvinism with the sovereign God to Arminianism with God no longer sovereign by man is. And that shift is going on, and it certainly isn't pockets, like we would say today, our nation today, as Christians in the nation today are generally Arminian, But there are pockets of Calvinists anywhere, everywhere. So understand what I'm saying about that. Okay, now, the French and Indian War, 1754. It becomes a global war in 1756 to 1763. The French and Indian War resulted from ongoing frontier tensions in North America as both French and British imperial officials and colonialists sought to extend each country's sphere. That's our little triangle. They're just, you know, jockeying for position. And we have the blue is representing the English side or the Allies, and the green is the France side. So you see it's kind of like the whole world involved in this question. In North America, the war pitted France, the French colonists, and the native allies against the Great Britain, the Anglo-American colonists, and the Iroquois Confederacy, which controlled most of the upstate New York and parts of the northern Pennsylvania. Don't get in details here, but just get a picture of this. I'm kind of get through this. Now, the border between France and British possessions was not well defined, and one disputed territory was the Upper Ohio River Valley. The French had constructed a number of forts in this region and attempt to strengthen their claim on the territory. And this is what the fight's all about. The British colonial forces, led by Lieutenant Colonel George Washington, attempted to expel the French in 1754, but were outnumbered and defeated by the French. Bad news. But the good news is, despite facing such formidable alliance, eventually the British naval strength and Spanish ineffectiveness led to British success. So British forces seized the French Caribbean islands, Spanish Cuba, and the Philippines. Fighting in Europe, now the bigger war, the Seven-Year War, ended with the failed Spanish invasion of Britain's ally, Portugal. In 1763, the French and Spanish diplomats began to seek peace with the Treaty of Paris. That ends the war. All right, now we got lots of debt. Lots of debt. Not only have a war in America or colonies, we have war in Europe. And England is on the wrong side, and they're the major players in it. We'll go through this. But we end up having that this land is ceded by the French. And you see how much bigger, all of a sudden, the colony's land is. So Great Britain secured, this is before the Revolution, remember? This is now Britain doing this. The Great Britain secured significant territorial gains in North America, including all the French territory east of the Mississippi River, as well as the French Florida down here. Although the treaty returned Cuba to Spain. Now, down here in John Quincy Adams in 1819, just a few years later, you know, all of Florida. I'm just building for you the American territories. Unfortunately for the British, the fruits of victory brought seeds of trouble with Great Britain's American colonies. The war had been enormously expensive, and the British government attempts to impose tax on colonists to help cover these expenses resulted in increasing colonial resentment of British attempts to expand imperial authority in the nations. And I'm thinking, well, now look, you guys, Britain defended your nation, pay your taxes. Well, probably not quite that easy or that simple, but that was part of the issue. So with the official end of the war, the Anglo-American colonists began to pour over the Appalachian Mountains. Remember, they got this from France in search of land, and Britain didn't want them to do that. As the native population had made no land concessions, secessions, many of these settlers had no official claim to land. So the colonists just went west over the land into the Indians. And the British didn't want to do that. Remember the little sore with France? They just took it from France. Now they're going to have these colonists move into there. Wasn't good for them, relation with France. Now, British attempts to limit Western expansion by colonists, inadvertent provocation of a major Indian war, further angered the British subjects. I think you got that picture. When the news of the rebellion reached London, the government decided to put an action into action a plan for creating a Western Indian Reserve, which would exclude the colonists, and so forth. These are things that are causing the colonists to be irritated. So we have wars with the tribes. I'm going to get through here. And at the end of the rebellion, regulation of the Western frontier was not significantly altered until British Parliament passed the Quebec Act. Now, here is very important because now it looks like Britain is taking the side of the Catholics, taking the side of the French against the colonists. Remember, the colonists are more afraid of the Catholics than they were of the Indians. So with this piece of legislation, the British intended to preempt any British attempt to preempt any dissatisfaction among the French Canadian population by restoring French civil law and allowing Catholics to hold office. So the Catholics are getting a better shrift than the colonists are. And they also opposed direct rule on Quebec and extended Quebec's borders south of the Ohio River. Colonists did not like that. So the Quebec Act angered the Virginian elite, since both the western lands they claimed were now officially part of Quebec or in the Indian Reserve. The act, which Parliament passed at the time as legislation, placing Massachusetts under the control of the crown, didn't like that either. All to fuel the resentment among Calvinist New Englanders, who saw it as autocratic, pro-Catholic provision, further evidence of an imperial conspiracy against colonial liberties. So when the American Revolution began in 1774, tensions between the settlers and Indians became part of the conflict. The Continental Congress, before the independence, attempt to secure Indian alliance largely failed. The Americans couldn't get along with the Indians. They'd rather be with the British. That's what happened. All right. Now, the ultimate effect of British frontier policy was to unite the frontiersmen, Virginian speculators, and the New Englanders against the unpopular British policies. These groups, angered by British taxation policies, forged revolutionary alliances with other colonists. For more than a decade before the outbreak of the American Revolution in 1775, tensions had been building between the colonists and the British authorities. Attempts by the British government to raise revenue by taxing the colonies, the Stamp Act, and then later the Tea Act, met with heated protest among the colonists who resented their lack of representation in Parliament and demanded the same rights as other British subjects. They were not British subjects. So the colonial resistance led to the violence in 1770, 6 years before the independence, when the British soldiers opened fire on a mob of colonists, killing 5 men in what is known as the Boston Massacre, and maybe some of you have been there. December 1773, a band of Bostonians dressed as Mohawk Indians boarded British ships, dumped chests of tea into the Boston Harbor, and outraged Parliament passed a series of measures known as Intolerable or Coercive Acts designed to reassert imperial authority in Massachusetts. Well, that was an act of war. Okay, I could recover this for you, but I'm going to leave it go.